Hi there, Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice Dyer in the Magnus Protocol. As part of the Magnus Archive's 10th anniversary, Rusty Quill is hosting a special Magnus Live show at the upcoming Crossed Wires Podcast Festival in Sheffield. Join co-creators Jonathan Sims and Alexander J. Newell on the 5th of July for a new iteration of our live show, Statement Begins, where you can hear fan-favourite statements such as Anglerfish, Red Live, and gain exclusive insights into the creation and history of the show straight from the creators themselves. You can buy your tickets now, including limited numbers of meet and greet tickets, from crossedwires.live or the link in the description of this episode.
Hello, and welcome to this special behind-the-scenes look at the making of Season 5 of the Magnus Archives. I'm your host, Anil Gudigamur, and with me I have...
Johnny Sims. Hello. Writer. Voice actor. Hero? Question mark?
Who can say? Johnny. Johnny can say.
I just did.
And Alex Newell. Hello. Director. Hero? Question mark? No. Antagonist? Question mark? Yes.
And me, Laurie, producer, overlord? Maybe.
And me, Elizabeth, editor? Hopefully not a question mark at this point.
To be fair, Elizabeth, the actual hero of the making of Season 5.
100%.
I mean, how many episodes? Like, I think by the 89th one, you can probably say that you're an editor at that stage.
Yeah.
I keep saying it. There are few people on the planet who have edited as much audio drama as you.
That is
probably true.
Yeah. So, 200 episodes, 5 years of audio drama, the curtain has finally closed, the stage has been swept. How are we all feeling?
I think relief, you know, is broadly speaking my primary emotion. Like, it's a bit sad because it's been so much of my life for, like, the last 5 years, but mainly, especially given how Season 5 has been to record, and it's just a real to have it all out there at last.
I, on the other hand, would like to shatter the grand illusion and say, only one person in this room is done with Magnus. And it's the person who spoke first.
Yeah, it's
how
the
do
person
you feel?
Who's feeling
like
the leaf. You'll
I've
get
still
there.
Got loads to do, Anil.
You'll get
That's
there,
the
Alex.
Truth. Because there's still loads to do.
That is
well,
true.
Well, yes, but the main body of the show is done.
I have to say, I have a different emotion. I think I was feeling... possibly partway through last year, I was like, when will this be over? But now, because I was a fan of the show, like, I am losing characters that I enjoyed, that I've just animated across a landscape. I'm like, I am losing a little bit of character family for
Aww,
myself.
That's yeah. sweet.
I mean, I didn't care about them that much between seasons one and two. But Season 5, I made their little feet go everywhere.
So. Yeah, that's the thing. You'll have heard more of, like, their little tippy-tap footsteps than you have, like, any other sound for the last year.
Every little shrug, every time Martin did something like this, hands up, hands down.
Yeah, I think from doing the transcripts, it's like, click and footsteps, I think, are the things I have written the most. Well, I guess it's safe to say that 2020 and Season 5 didn't quite pan out the way we'd expected. Before we talk about, like, the production challenges, let's go back to the beginning on the writing front and what I'm guessing are the heady, heady days of 2019.
Ah, the before time.
The before times. But, Johnny, you've said before that Magnus Archives was planned as a 5-series show. Could you talk a little bit about your overall vision and how Season 5 fitted in with that?
Season 5, the final act of the Magnus Archives, Act 5, as it were, was always intended to be this post-apocalyptic, Weirdmageddon odyssey to a certain degree. It was always going to culminate with the Archivist's choice and taking on the power and releasing the fears sort of out into these other worlds, largely because I am an absolute sucker for... like it, they're so cheesy, but I love... your old school creepypasta, and now you too, reader, are doomed, for you have read these words, and these words are how the curse was passed. And so I was like, I really want to do, like, just 5 seasons, leading to a really, like, the slowest burn, one of those. But the basic skeleton's been in place pretty much from, like, about halfway through season one, I'd say. But obviously the exact format has changed and shifted. I think originally it was going to be a slightly shorter run of episodes. I wanted actually initially to do a sort of kind of a fake out with the early part of season four.
Yeah.
So that the apocalypse came like, I don't know, episode like 17, just out of the blue in season five, which Alex pushed back on, saying that it would be really hard to maintain that much of early season five when there were effectively no actual stakes. And so
it's fine, you can say it. What I did is I said no one wants an office romance for 10 episodes. No one would enjoy that, Johnny. It's boring, so let's skip that and go straight to the misery.
Have you actually seen the fan reactions?
We don't have fans. This all just gets put in a filing cabinet somewhere.
But the actual format of season five, sort of beyond the idea of like they are traveling the apocalypse, seeing these, like the idea of the apocalypse and the fearscapes, checking in on all these older characters in their sort of final forms, effectively, that was there. But as it got closer and I wanted to experiment a bit more with my writing, it took on this much more Odyssey format of like one end of a fear transformed British Isles right down to the other.
In your defense as well, like when you were originally talking about it, you were trying not to force us to reinvent the entire series, and like, and we could do maybe 10 episodes post-apocalypse, would that be okay? And I was like, no, 40. We'll do 40 and we'll triple the soundscaping. So like, you were quite humble in the original like proposition. I have to like give you credit, as I just told you to scale it up and you rolled with it.
Did you have anything in particular that you wanted to try or achieve with the writing of this season?
Broadly speaking, I wanted to experiment a bit more. The statement format of the first four seasons has evolved as the meta plot and the interpersonal drama has developed, but it always stayed pretty grounded to one degree or another in the real world. And I was very keen to experiment a bit more with the actual format of the statements, with the writing, and use this idea of like the psychoscape and these sort of personal hells to just sort of, I guess, flex my writing muscles in some different ways. Also, it's a paradox that the more surreal the actual setting, in many ways, the more real you can be with the subject matter and with the, like, the interpersonal drama. People reacting against these very externalized metaphors can lead to some really interesting character moments that weren't as possible when the world was normal. And you have to deal with, in metaphorical monsters, when the world is real, are sort of literalized in a very interesting way when you take this idea of like the world becoming this inherent metaphor.
I mean, I'd argue as well that it's more than just you can go more real, you sort of have to. Otherwise you're just this untethered balloon in floating around in a big pile of weird.
Monsters are metaphors, and so the more of the world that is a monster, the more of the world has to be a metaphor, otherwise you're just describing an untethered hell, which, you know, is fine, I guess, but you kind of want something a bit more there.
What was writing like at the start of the season compared to towards the end?
In many ways, not super different. Like, I think it took me a few episodes to properly settle into what we were trying to do. And I would say that the last 10 episodes, a lot of the final plot beats land, and there's a lot of long-deferred conversations that need to happen. That was both harder and easier than the journey preceding it. Easier because a lot of these scenes were so kind of necessary, and I don't want to say obvious, but like, I know how this scene goes because it's a scene that's been rattling around my brain for like 3 years now or so. But at the same time, there was a lot more pressure on it because it's like, yeah, but if this scene doesn't land, this series doesn't land, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think in some ways the early bits were easier. Also, like pre-pandemic, it was a lot easier because writing is hard in a pandemic.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Johnny, you're forced to stay at home. Surely that means all you do is write with interruptions it's, forever,
it's
right?
It's wonderful.
Yep. Said every creative ever. On that point, were there any particular sticking points with the writing for season five?
I mean, the last sort of, I want to say 15 episodes went through quite a few chops and changes with Alex. Like, there was the exact order of scenes and the exact order of things ended up getting a little bit shuffled around.
Well, I mean, in your defense, there was production pressure as well.
Yeah.
Which was, there's no point dancing around it, is that although season five was written with a sort of semi-Odyssey act structure built in, originally it was structured for a mid-break, because that's what we normally would be fine with, and then you carry on. But that was physically impossible unless I literally started feeding people to the machine to keep it going. So as a result, we ended up splitting it harder into that three act. So it meant that you kind of needed to account for that.
And it also meant that we had to factor in, like, for instance, we couldn't have Basira and Daisy periodically recurring throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
Because from a practical point of view, when Frank and Faye had a microphone, was like, we could make sure they had a microphone at any point we wanted. But it wasn't as easy to say, well, they'll need a microphone throughout the whole deal. So a lot of it was down to, because me and Alex and Imogen, for instance, who plays Helen, because she's also in Stella Firma, there were a handful of us who had basically permanent recording setups. A lot of the mid-season five was very much like, this is by production necessity, focused down much closer on these characters. Like, I think it was always going to be primarily John and Martin wandering through the wastes, but that sort of slightly peripatetic sectional feel, like, oh, well, these are the three, four episodes with Daisy and Basira in the middle, was, I think, much more of a production consequence than one that was initially planned.
But you did basically allow us to mobilise with the remote recording kits by doing that, so I don't actually think it's worse for it, I'd say. A lot of times people say the change happens and then it's, you know, oh, you've sacrificed the original vision. I'm like, actually, I kind of like that it fell out that way.
I think we've, broadly speaking, been quite good at, like, having a lot of two-way communication over the production stuff. It's a lot less like you coming in and saying, well, these are the restraints, so make it work, and me saying, well, this is my writing demand, make sure it works.
Sat on his throne of bone.
And much more like us having a proper conversation and saying, well, these are constraints, what can we do within the writing to make this work and to actually, like, capitalize on it? Like, what is this an opportunity for thematically?
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Conversely, were there any parts that came very easily?
By the end, the Martin and John dialogue, it's one of those things that, like, after 5 years, you know how these characters talk and communicate so deeply. Martin and John have a heartfelt conversation about the apocalypse, and Martin stubbornly sits on a horrible sofa. Like, I'm like, yeah, I can write that. That's fine. Boof, done.
I'm looking at Elizabeth wince at the mention of that sofa, and you're like,
yeah,
sitting on a squeaky sofa. That's dead easy. That's 2 seconds of writing, and Elizabeth's there.
I remember that.
You're so tactful.
I think Elizabeth's just waiting for the editing section.
Yeah. During that, they're probably slightly more towards adding Alex into this. When did planning proper for season five begin, and how did that go?
From an audience point of view, it was underway by the time season four was, like, complete, because there's obviously that delay.
I have a date.
Oh, yeah.
So I remember that we had a big meeting in December 2019 as, like, a debrief of season four.
Yes!
And I don't think you'd done the final, like, detailed scene plan at that point, and you were going to do it in the next few weeks.
You're right. We knew what we wanted to do genuinely around, like, end of season three, and it was a question of, like, execution. How long is it? 20 episodes in apocalypse? Is it all in apocalypse? Whatever. And you're right, that was the meeting where we sat down and poor Johnny had to sit in a room and just be told no for like an hour. Where it was just like, cool, I thought we could, no, It must have these characters. It must run at this length. You cannot have these characters more than this amount of time. It must only have this.
To be fair, like, a lot of the meeting was you're saying, oh, it's got to have this, and me being like, yes, of course, that makes sense. And there was only, like, 30% of it that was, like, me being like, I want this one, and they're like, we can't do that.
I mean, that was the meeting where I said we need to plan to not have Celeza.
Yeah.
In case it didn't come off, as an example.
Mm.
But that said, with Season 5 much more than any other season, planning, in inverted commas, has gone pretty much right up to the end. With all the other seasons, there was the initial two or three meetings where me and Alex hashed out the shape of the season. Then I'd go away and make my episode plan. And then the main question was, how do we do this? How do we make this actually work? Whereas with Season 5, because of pandemic concerns, a few structural things that we noticed as we came towards the end, there was much more of that, well, what do we do? How are we shaping this? There were much more of those conversations right throughout Season 5.
Yeah,
I'd say it had slightly more real-world course corrections, where it's like, oh, like, this is going to be physically impossible to record, so we'll need to, you know... There was a version, as an example, where, like, if we couldn't get decent recording setups to them, Celeza was behind bulletproof glass and talking through an intercom and stuff like that. And it's like, because that could work, you know? So yeah, I think out of all of the seasons, this is the one that's had the most reconfirming and little adjustments here and there, but it's almost all been to, like, facilitate rather than rewrite, if that makes any sense.
Sure. When did principal recording for Season 5 start?
Well, I looked this up, and our first recording for Season 5 was on the 18th of January 2020. And it was a John Martin scene in the first episode. And on that day, we also recorded, us five recorded making of episode 158.
Yeah, because I remember coming to the recording for the making of 158, and Mike was just leaving.
I think that was might have been the... Oh, no, it would have been the first scene, right?
Yeah, because he's in the tape recording at the beginning of Season 5
as well.
Oh, my
God, I forgot. That's how Season 5 starts.
Yeah. I had as well.
Oh, I forgot. That was so much fun to plan.
Yeah.
Just to be arbitrarily cruel in that way. Oh, yeah. I forgot.
I walked up to your front door. It opened. Mike walked out. He's like, oh, I didn't know you were here today. I think that may have also been the day of our staff party as well. Like the last party where we were all together.
Oh, yeah.
That was, yeah.
Before shutdown. Principal recording started in January before we knew anything about, really, about how things were going. So how did the plan for Season 5 change as the year progressed?
Through a couple of, like, emergency meetings when we first went into lockdown, followed by weekly updates and discussions and all this sort of thing. I'll be honest, at this point, I've been doing the, like, revised and changed. I couldn't tell you, oh, it was going to be X or Y, and then it changed in this or that way. But certainly the initial plan was much more sort of, I think, interweaving with other characters' stories rather than compartmentalizing them in the way that it ended up being. Also, just, like, the way that dialogue worked. I had to be a lot more careful to not write too much crosstalk, at least in the earlier parts of the pandemic when everyone was still getting used to their remote recording setups. By the end, me and Alex, even with a video delay, we could crosstalk, act off each other without any problem.
Oh yeah, that's a that's a fun insight. There are a few scenes that I've recorded as Martin where, due to internet issues, Johnny at the other end, to what I'm hearing, it's like, hello John, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine.
How are you? And then you're just like, okay, we'll just, I know how you probably would have said that.
Yeah, like, the thing is, like, at a certain point, we've been acting these characters off each other for long enough that I'm just like, okay, well, I've no idea what Alex just said, but the timing he would usually use is this, so let's just go.
I believe my timing consists of awkward pause.
When was the decision taken to move to fully remote recording? And was there any consideration given to delaying production or the launch of Season 5?
I have come to this with a list of dates to help jog memories because I couldn't remember.
Excellent.
But our last studio recording day was the 14th of March, and it was with Hannah Walker recording Jude Perry.
The Towering Inferno episode.
So that was almost exactly a year ago today.
Like, we were already well underway in setting up for remote recording at that point.
Yeah. We were quite lucky, I think. Well, from my point of view, I don't know how much things were changed. I don't remember these scenes being changed, but I think we had a bunch of John Martin scenes coming up, and you both, I think Johnny was, am I right, prioritised or had a recording kit at that time?
No, I didn't quite. In fact, I had no home recording until pandemic hit and my government company started doing streaming, at which point we bought our own recording kit. That was ended up being supplemented a couple of places by what Rusty Quill was sending out. Fundamentally, Alex very wisely, yeah, this is not going to be a short thing. We need to make sure that we are in a position to keep recording if it ends up being months or years.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a pandemic paranoia person, as being forced as a child to read The Hot Zone by my mother, who was like, this is a thing that you'll need to deal with in your lifetime. So as a result, I may have been slightly primed to the point where I think during that Hannah Walker, we'd already made the call that we basically were going to be in remote recording till, I think we might have even given out the company message like, we're assuming we're going to be doing remote recording till end of 2021 unless a miracle happens or something. Like, we basically have had swapped by April to just, we will be doing this permanently until further notice. So yeah, I think we were quite lucky in a way that I don't often concede, in that we had a bunch of John Martin we could be doing so that we did not have to completely tank season 5 start. From a business perspective, I pushed quite hard because pandemic was going to shut down a lot of shows, especially in the podcast space, and sustaining launch would be a big deal, would be an achievement in and of itself, even if it meant that we swapped to the 3-act structure. So I think a lot of it was a lot of people putting a lot of extra effort, but a lot of the people who were like saving it, in inverted commas on here, April Sumner, Hannah Brankin, actually a few of the editors who helped like generating suggestions on tech, including you, Elizabeth, I think, where it was effectively coming up with what the remote recording stuff was. That was logistically massive. Like, that was enormous, but we were quite lucky that we could just record a bunch of John Martin whilst mobilizing, you know, 20, 30 remote recording kits.
And you bought every microphone left in England.
Oh, I did. Yes, I did. Oh, there's your fun anecdote. Yeah, I may have gone, hang on, every single person on the planet is going to want to make a podcast because they're going to be bored at home. And I need to have this specific equipment if it's going to sound good. So because they hadn't stocked up yet, I did temporarily purchase every single type of this microphone that was available in this country for like a couple of weeks. And it was just because they normally stock, you know, like 2. And every single shop I was like, I'll take 30. And so we had to like clean out like genuinely like 10 separate suppliers or something. So then for 2 weeks, just this microphone wasn't available in the UK and it was my fault. I forgot about that. You'd see all these advice forums being like, hi, I'm trying to start a podcast during pandemic, but I can't find this microphone. You just sat there watching comments of people going, yeah, it's weird. There used to be loads and now there's none. I don't know what's happening there.
In your defense, like, the issue was that there weren't a lot of these microphones stockpiled in any given supplier.
Oh, yeah, they hadn't stockpiled like anything, and then demand like,
they would have vanished
skyrocketed.
Anyway, but at the same time, they vanished because of you.
It's similar to the streaming situation, because like stocks of certain like Logitech cameras, particularly like the C920, yeah, ran out. So, Laurie, when Alex told you we were going to move to fully remote, what were your initial thoughts?
I think my first thoughts went to all of the recordings and the guests we had booked, and just, you know, right, what do we do here? And the next recording we had booked that, you know, would have gone ahead had we not had to go remote was with Chioma, who plays Annabelle, which we were unlucky in a way because this was our first recording with her ever. So, you know, we hadn't met her and we were supposed to be meeting her for the first time this day. But we were lucky because what she was recording was a phone call.
Oh, yeah!
Literally, we were like, you know what? I think we can get away with her recording on her phone, because she didn't have a kit and we couldn't have got it to her in time, because I don't think we had them at that point.
This is a real insight into just how pathetic I am. Do you not remember our fun character cascade algorithm we had to work on?
Yeah.
It was this fun thing where it was like, right, you can only have so many people in a call, otherwise the call collapses. Therefore, you can split it out. But we need to batch people because some people can't have you can't give a full recording set to every single character to keep for 12 months. They've got to move around. It was one of those math problems where it's, you know, like a train leaves London at 20 miles an hour and another leaves Timbuktu because what was the minimum number of transfers and stuff of
this
equipment?
This is your super dorky spreadsheet you showed me once.
Yeah! Lowry, I just gave a bunch of parameters to Lowry. Went, you're a mathematician, figure it out.
So just swapping back a little bit. So you said there wasn't really a decision to delay or push back the launch of season 5. So we recorded a message from you that went out before the start of the season. But I have to ask, Johnny, what was it like feeling so prescient about the apocalypse? Particularly with things like The Thick Village.
Oh, that hurt. That episode hurt me physically.
I remember for a fair part of that early season, we made sure to preface things with cautions about the content. Like, something like the first 5-6 episodes all went out with warnings.
Being isolated in a cabin followed by you go outside and there's nothing but sickness. Yeah.
God.
It was a weird one, because at some points in season 5, like, because season 5 is diving into, like, much more real-world fears and, like, real-world experiences. Like, there have been some heavy episodes that this one's a lot, but there is a real difference in going into an episode saying, okay, well, this is engaging with something pretty raw, pretty personal to me, versus just putting out an episode that's like, yeah, this is a meditation on this thing, and by the time it comes out, it's suddenly massively directly applicable to everyone listening. I don't have any other good words to say except it's really weird. Not great. I would much rather those episodes had not been prescient and everyone had just been, that's an okay episode. Let's not remember it.
But look at it another way. What if you'd have done an episode of them trapped in the cabin and they go outside and it's nothing but clowns? 2020 would have been a very different year for the world.
The clowndemic.
Well, we're not going to talk about Clowncore on this episode, but despite its relevance to the Magnus Archives. So, Lowry, what were the challenges you faced in getting the rest of the season recorded as producer?
Well, first it's that adjustment and the mental switch of, okay, everything's completely different, all the prep I've done means nothing. But I think we're probably getting into kind of the sound and the editing side of things now, because one of the biggest challenges is, of course, that everyone's setup is different. You know, we're not in a studio. Everyone's atmosphere is different and you have to try and match that, trying to think of ways to mitigate those differences. I mean, obviously, it wasn't me who was coming up with those solutions. And I think for me, I felt like there was a sense of going into the unknown, like we didn't know what we didn't know yet. So, you know, for example, we'd be recording things, you know, it's a remote recording setup and, you know, everyone's in different places and you'd think, oh, okay, this is a thing that we hadn't considered that will affect us and we should probably think about beforehand in the future. It added a few extra steps to production as well. So things like, oh, we need to be getting test audio from people and we need to be getting it a week before their recording so that if there are any issues with their setup and their atmosphere and their audio, we can solve those before the recording day.
And then you're explaining to actors, no, you've got to use the actual setup you're going to use. Don't give us a test recording. Just on your phone and then use a different setup and stuff like that.
Teaching actors how to soundproof their own rooms.
No, it's not that. It's just that you now have to, hi, this is a casting call. Cool. Are you a performer? Yes, great. Are you an audio technician? What? No. Learn.
And also explaining, yes, you've sent us test audio using the mic that we sent you, but we need you to be literally recording in the space you're going to be recording in with it set up as it's going to be on the day, because that affects the quality so much, almost as much as the quality of the microphone.
I had to learn a lot about acoustics. It's not like a bad thing. It's not like, oh, I can't believe I had to learn about acoustics. But it was definitely a... Also, like, the idea of checking a spectrograph never crossed my mind. And then we lost, like, a literal day's worth of recording on my end because there was some problem that would have shown up if I checked the spectrograph, but we didn't. So just did the whole recording being like, yes, this is fine, really enjoying this recording. And then it's like, this is... Johnny, this is completely unusable. Sounds like you're underwater.
And then the awful one where everyone did a fantastic job, but the audio equipment reset, so they just recorded to the wrong microphone. So they've got the brilliant microphone set up, everything looks like it's working fine, and they've recorded via their, like, £3 webcam, and you're like, oh, no, God.
Well, I mean, because everyone has, you know, we can send out the certain recording equipment, but most people are recording into their own laptop or device, right? So, and we don't have control over that.
We have tested every iteration of every, like, setup we possibly could before we came to this. And this was the one that was a combination of the easiest to get someone to learn combined with least likely to create audio errors and crashes and stuff. But it took a long time. And Johnny's right to be annoyed because it's been the bane of my life.
The amount of experimentation it took to locate the exact right things to turn off so that Skype wasn't just gradually increasing my recording volume throughout the whole recording was a lot. But at the same time, yeah, like, all the, like, the more specialist tools out there are a lot harder for, like, if you're just getting an actor in to, like, do an episode, it's a lot more upfront to sort of unload onto them. And at a certain point, you just have to be like, do you have Skype? I think so. Great, it's over Skype. Plus, to be honest, when we started, Teams and Zoom weren't as big as they are now.
Yeah.
Actually, that is another big thing. So you're recording usually, you know, Alex is there and, you know, he's acting as the sound engineer. So you're pretty confident. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, things can go wrong, but usually once the audio is recorded, it's done, it's, you know, it's there and you can rely on that.
Yeah.
But then recording remotely and, you know, waiting for everyone to send their audio in, not that, like, anyone was late or, you know, slow sending stuff in, but you can't just tick that off as being done. You have to wait, you know, so that it's been checked and maybe gone through a few editors so that all the different ways that it could have gone wrong have, you know, been eliminated. And it's like, okay, after all this time, it sounds like that audio was okay. I can tick that as being done.
Were there any actual positives from a production perspective that came out of this? Like, any benefits or unexpected wins that came from, like, this new normal of remote recording?
Studio's never been cleaner. You're all just animals, and every time you come into a room, you leave it, and it's like a whirlwind of muddy footprints. This is glorious.
Well, you've turned the studio into your actual office now.
It's my sterile soundproof bubble.
I just figured it was having a cast and crew who are now trapped at home and had no excuses.
You're available, right? I had this thing. No, you don't.
I technically got to sleep a bit later on a recording day. The trouble is that actually that works worse because before I was having to, like, crawl out of bed at 7 and take a 2-hour train and bus ride over to Alex's. And the thing is, that 2-hour train and bus ride, like, I'd get myself a coffee and, like, a bacon sandwich. I'd listen to Sonic the Comic the podcast and just, like, take that time to wake up. And so by the time I arrived at Alex's, I was like, yeah, ready to record. Whereas in pandemic, I've much more been, like, just bleariedly eyed, like, trying to set up a microphone at, like, 9:05. Yeah, I don't need to. It's fine. I'm already in the room I record in. It's fine. And being like, I'm here!
Yeah, actually, thinking about it, early pandemic was the big one for that because we were worried that we weren't going to be able to catch up. People are busy dealing with pandemic. And instead it was every single person on the planet's plans have been cancelled. Which means that every single person, it's like, yeah, I guess I'm free. Like, I'm not going to that opera or whatever. So it weirdly made it feasible to catch up more than I actually thought we'd be able to in the first stages.
I mean, it was harder in the sense as well that we had to get mics to people and also coordinate with other shows as well.
Yeah, yeah.
another win, I'd say, is that it opened up the casting for us. I had been looking since January 2020 for an actor of Samoan descent that lived in London, or who could feasibly get to London. And I'd just been having no luck. And I can't remember exactly when, but I remember one day during the lockdown, I woke up and was like, we don't need someone who's in London. We can cast anywhere, like even Australia, which Alex agreed to. And to clarify, Australia specifically, because I had an Australian director friend who had worked with a few Samoan actors who live in Australia. So I reached out to them and their agents, and that's actually how we ended up casting Salesa.
And Ray was, oh, Ray was wonderful to work with.
Oh, he was a ray of light.
International shipping is not fun. Once it's there, moving around within country is fine. Getting things to countries can sometimes be tricky. Let's leave it at that.
I will say the fans very definitely reacted well to Ray's casting as Salesa. He was very, very popular.
How about you, Elizabeth? I'm assuming that from your end, it's basically all been positive with remote recording with no negatives at all, right?
It was a dream. Dream year. It's great, great fun. We all learned lots. Just lots. Because I'd come from seasons 2, 3, and 4 where it was all recorded in the studio. And so I'd just grown up on this beautiful audio that just never needed anything. You know, just needed to adjust the levels. Didn't need to EQ it other than running it through the, you know, telephone filter that we use. To, yeah, having to deal with this audio that was coming in where I think it stumped a lot of the editing team to like really, you know, shape some of that so that it sounded as good as possible.
There were a few exterior scenes that ended up interior by the end, but I think it worked.
Moving now to the editing side, Elizabeth, speaking as an editor or for the editing team, what are the main differences in handling audio that is coming from multiple locations compared to it all being nicely in situ in studio?
So, I mean, you've got, I think the two main things are obviously the fact that the audio is not going to sound the same because of the reverberance that each room has. You know, every space has some kind of reverberance. And then the other thing is working with audio where there was, I think for Annie and Nico, who did most of those edits this year, they probably had to do a lot more of the Franken voicing where it's taking two records where potentially those people weren't actually recording at the same time. And of course, dealing with lag. Those, I think, are the two main differences from the studio. Like the studio obviously does still have nice padding on it, so you don't
get... It's lovely hair.
Yeah, looking good. Whereas, yeah, there's only so much that most people can do in their bedroom or their lounge to reduce the amount of reflection that their walls are going to give to the sound, so...
But there's a beautiful narrative closure there that Magnus started in a blanket form and it ended not in a big fancy studio, but just in a lot of blanket forts. More like a blanket community. A blanket hamlet.
Oh, it's fine. I'm happy. I love the completion of a narrative arc.
Indeed you do. Elizabeth, you moved from being the vocal cut editor to principally doing the soundscaping for season 5. So how did that feel?
It came with a lot more feeling of responsibility. I love the show because I love the characters and I just like, I enjoy being involved in media. Like, you know, I just enjoyed the show. So it was always something that I've been passionate about. But the amount of audience hadn't really sunk in. And so I remember Callum, we've got this many downloads a month. And I was like, holy shit. I feel very responsible at this point. So because also the vocal cuts, you know, cutting the dialogue for something, I mean, it doesn't disappear, but you know, when it's done well, you're not paying attention to that, right? That's just something that feels seamless and you're the invisible presence that made that come off fine. I think with the soundscaping, you're telling people a lot more about, well, you're telling people everything about the environment if you start adding soundscaping in, right? So you're saying, well, you know, we've got this hospital. Well, what sort of hospital is it? Like, what sort of environment do we have here? So, and then of course, once you're adding that soundscape layer as well, it's got to be believable enough. If you have everyone thumping around, not sounding realistic, you're just going to take everyone out of that environment. I would actually prefer, if I was listening to a podcast, something that had less soundscaping if they weren't going to do it well enough for it to be believable. Because to me, like, the story is the most important thing. And what I'd hate to do is distract from, you know, the narratives that Johnny was telling.
You say that, but, like, as you say, the soundscaping is so important for the environment. And because so much of season five is about the environment. Oh, and I say, oh, like, season five, Elizabeth is 100% the third author. It's literally the fact that, like, a lot of the decisions that you take in the soundscaping have these sort of very significant and transformative impacts on the episodes, and it's been wonderful to, like, come to some of them and be like, oh wow, that's not what I wrote, because that's better, you know?
No, all you ever wrote was just, there's the sounds of tens of thousands of people screaming.
Yeah.
And it's real difficult to keep that fresh.
It's not so much that it's not what I wrote, in the sense that, like, that is different from what I wrote. It's like, well, what I wrote was, like, a line of description. What Elizabeth has come back with is so transformative to it. And often, occasionally, people have been like, oh, yeah, like, this particular thing in the episode, that really spoke to me. I was like, I don't recall writing that in. And I go back to listen, and I'd be like, oh, that's just a really cool sound effect that was dropped in there.
But that draws attention so much to, and this is biggest in audio drama, actually, there is far more directorial action that happens at the sound effect soundscaping layer than people give credit for. This isn't even talking like from a procedural point, it's talking about like from the nature of how you consume this, right? Body language is a thing, okay? In audio drama, inferred body language is a thing. There's a very big difference between a character who says, yes, I agree, and someone who says, yes, I agree, then fidgets uncomfortably. Those are different scenes. So as a result, a lot of that is Elizabeth's readings of scripts, where sometimes it's codified, but even if it's not codified, Elizabeth doesn't have the luxury of just leaving it blank. People don't just sit perfectly still in a void. So as a result, you can imply a lot, and I think it's probably the thing that's the least appreciated and thing that you smashed with season five. And it's stuff like rowing the boat, where it's the thing of when they choose to stop rowing the boat, when they start again, how does that interact and things like that. You learn a lot about the characters just by that, and it's the bit that no one really pays attention to, but it's the thing that when it's missing, they'll say, oh, it just feels like talking heads, and it's because it's missing an entire layer of sound design, which is what you are very good at, like really, really good at.
To be fair, it's not always been purely Elizabeth's interpretation. Sometimes she has dropped me messages on Teams being like, hey, what do you mean by this? I'll go back to script and then I'll say, I don't care.
But I will say this definitively. If the sound design is coherent in any way in season five, it's because Elizabeth has agonized in a way that I have personally breezed past before. What are the rules for this thing? I don't know, does it sound scary? Well, no, that doesn't make sense. It has to make sense. And now we have entire systems in place where Elizabeth's been like, I will make this coherent and wonderful.
Yeah, the soundscapes are good despite myself and Alex. Not because of.
Delving a little bit deeper on that, Elizabeth, how do you set about soundscaping an apocalypse?
I mean, obviously you've got just, I suppose, the general rules of sound design that you'd have, which is like you're going to have an environment, which is your background sounds and some mid-ground sounds. And then you've got your character movement. So basically for this show particularly, we needed to think of it in advance for quite a bit. I needed to get from Johnny and Alex an idea of like where everything was going to be set so that I'd have enough forewarning about whether there was going to be environments which were the same. So the hospitals actually came up three times in different ways. And I needed to be able to create environments which were going to sound separate from one another. Needing to map out, like, okay, were there going to be conflicts? And I think the hospital was the big one, where to give, like, depth to the first one, which was the psychiatric hospital, it still needed that kind of NHS psychiatric hospital rather than, like, creepy house psychiatric hospital because it's very hard to like do that in an audio way. But that meant I really went hard to the second hospital with the much more violent kind of surgery feel to it. Especially with the EQ range that we're working in, like there's certain things, if you went organic, you can do like the knuckle popping kind of sound, but actually that gets really lost in our EQ. Anytime someone got hit in the head or smashed by something, it was normally about 7 layers of sound just to give it enough depths because the EQ that we have, it just makes everything sound quite small. I think the other thing was we never really super talked about how we all envisioned the world working, and my vision of it is subtly different, I think, from your guys. The way that I built the world, particularly when we dove into doing the statements with them quite soundscaped. My world was that, you know, like John and Martin would enter these domains and they would be seeing the framework for other people's fear. So they'd be in like a domain. They would be like in the prison domain. You know, you sort of hear a couple of people murmuring or something. But for those people who are murmuring or who are crying, they're hearing or they're experiencing their own facet of that.
Personal, yeah, yeah.
Everyone's in their own fear bubble, which also explains why, you know, if they interact with John and Martin, they can't remember their name, they can't, all that sort of stuff. My idea was that the fears were warping around each person. But yeah, so when John and Martin walk into something, they just experience the kind of framework that allows a domain to exist.
I think as well, like, it's the best example of scope creep in season 5 is entering into season 5. I'll be honest, the original plan was, when it comes to the monologues, we'll put them in a static environment that is being on stage for someone else's fear, but not necessarily like in their fear. And then we can allude to it here or there, whatever. And it became very apparent as it carried on that the intimacy of the statements precluded that perspective. Because they were landing a little flat if you don't have it, but that meant that suddenly it has gone from these are some monologues with a nice kind of generic environment around them to narrative journeys, which is, if you actually compare stylistically, a complete genre shift of the show between season 4 and season 5, and B is a completely different technical undertaking, which means that poor Elizabeth entered with, like, what's the soundscaping for this? It's like a 5. And then, like, within 3 episodes, like, what's the soundscaping for this? 10 till the end of the season.
What would you say is the strangest or the most fun Foley or sound effect you had to create for season 5?
The process for editing is normally that, for the sound effects, that you download a lot of them from different sites or from, you know, you can get sound effects packs. Because obviously if you're doing something which is like 40 episodes and you've got 50 weeks to do it in, like, it's you're not going to do a lot of your own Foley, like, especially when you're trapped in the house. So I recorded the trains outside my house for one show. Also, having trains outside your house isn't very good for Foley either. But there is a couple of spots. One is being under my duvet, drinking a glass of water poorly so that I would sound like I was choking a little bit. Whatever the one is where you can hear someone like choking and sort of gasping. That's me.
The vast episode across the lake.
I figured that had to be you because there's no way you found a sample that clean of that. No way.
That's me gasping away. But I think the one which is, it's just the saddest one, 199, where Martin is comforting John and it's like there's like just a fabric noise of like hand padding across. I just knew exactly this right sort of sound, so I was just sitting in my bedroom alone, gently comforting myself. I'm like, it's been a year. I'm just going to pat myself for audio and pretend that someone's here to care about my feelings.
That's brilliant.
So, yeah.
Oh, God. On behalf of the fans, I'm going to ask, are you willing to tell us how you created fabric rustles?
Oh, fabric rustles. Not by myself. I will have you guys know as well, there's at least one hug in that series, which Johnny did not write.
So, well, there's
please,
plenty.
Please be giving me all the love for the fabric rustles. It is just literally clothing movements.
I'm pretty sure that fabric rustles is not my stage direction. Like, I'm pretty sure I will write in, like, they hug or they embrace.
Yeah. I think that came out of like following on from the talk that we had with making 158, where it was like with Alex being vehement about kissing, or like the talks that we've had about soundscaping kissing and how to actually have affection show up on audio.
You can have like one, maybe two, but if it's any more than that, it's not a pleasant listening experience. I'm sorry. That is a reality of it. So you got to pick your moments. That's all it is.
So, Elizabeth, what soundscape or episode are you proudest of?
188, actually, which is a woman who sort of, she leaves, she goes to a therapist and she comes back home. I quite like the transitions that I got to do in those. And I quite like the eye monster noise behind the wall, like the pulsing eye monster noise.
Oh, that was very visceral.
Yeah. So there's been other editors involved, like Maddie and Tessa, who've helped build some of the samples and things for the soundscapes. And so, you know, like parts of London, like the little camera chorus, as it's referred to, which is like the little cameras everywhere, is something that Tessa built out for me. So that's been very helpful. I think I was just very glad when I got past the stage of like having to turn to Alex and be like, I don't know how to do this thing, and just push in the files and be like, I did my best and I know it's not good enough.
There was a big gear shift with you from, I'm not sure if this is right, to, Alex, this is right. This is right. I don't care. You're wrong. This is right. And you were correct. And you were right to make that gear change.
So are there any parts of the soundscaping that you would change looking back on it?
I mean, I think everybody who creates would probably say yes, you would go back and change all the episodes, but I think you can't. If I got to work on each episode for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month, they would be slightly better, like ever so slightly better, or maybe I would have found a bit of a better sample to do this explosion with or something. Yeah, I think just like every other creator, you would love to go back and change it, but also, you know, it would be just a time sink.
How does making season 5 compare practically and emotionally from either season 1 or your first season working on the show?
Season 5 for me is simultaneously closer to season 1 than I would have expected, maybe emotionally on the making side, even if practically it was wildly different, because for season 1 we had to invent a bunch of processes in order to get anything out the other end. And then for season 5, we've had to invent a bunch of processes in order to get anything out the other end. So that feels like I weirdly went full circle. However, the problems have gone from, how do I plug in this microphone so that it doesn't explode? And have become, how do I negotiate international shipping agreements with Brexit trade negotiations ongoing? Like, it's still just a series of very quick solutions to problems.
For me, like, kind of similar in the sense that, like, seasons 3 and 4 felt very professional. Like, we knew what we were doing, like, we had the processes pretty much down, and there was a lot of running back and forth, but fundamentally, it felt like, yeah.
Season 4 especially.
Because season 5, I was like, it was a lot more making do and figuring out. It did feel a bit more like season 1 in that sort of sense. The big difference between it for me is like season 1, it's like, oh, I'm writing my first proper horror thing, putting out in the world, I hope people like it. And season 5 was like, oh no, people like it, go away, oh god.
I hope people look at this versus people stop looking at this.
Okay, everyone's looking at it. This is a lot.
Yeah, it goes from look at me to look at me between these hours for a small amount and only with one eye. Just
look away a bit.
Look away for a while now, please.
What lessons would each of you say that you have learned from season 5?
I think I have learned a lot practically about writing. I think I've developed certain styles. Like, I think I've gotten better at writing a lot of stuff. In terms of the overall plotting, I don't know if there is much I would say I've learned. Like, most of the stuff that I'm coming away from is also stuff that I kind of knew going into it. You go into this sort of thing being like, well, landing a 200 episode season, you make some narrative compromises. Like, you're not going to be able to tie up everything you want to, like, and it's slightly different to actually experience that and have to make those calls. Being like, yes, intellectually, I know that this is coming. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that, like, there's any single glaring lesson that I'm like, I did not realise this going into season five, and I do now.
I think for me as well, there's been a lot of small things. I don't think there's any one particular huge thing. Apart from, you just don't have as much time as you think you have. Or I suppose you will fill that time. Like, I don't know about you, but that, I feel like that's a lesson that I just keep relearning through life.
Well, I came in with the show with limited kind of soundscaping experience. So obviously there was a learning curve in terms of just getting those skills up to the level that Alex wanted. And I mean, I wanted. I've learned to please one man. There we go. Every woman's dream. I'm a child of my time. I just can't help it.
And that's all that matters.
Oh, God.
Yikes.
I always remember when I did broadcasting school, like one of our teachers was like, everything you do will be twice as hard and sound half as good as what you want it to be. And so, like, it just, if you're listening out there, gentle listener, it takes a lot of effort to do one of these things. Like, way more than you'd expect.
excuse me, Anil. What have you learned?
Yeah, what have you learned, Anil?
Yeah.
I have learned that trying to pull all of these disparate parts together and communicate this to people, to the listening public, is a lot harder than I had expected it to be, particularly because when the pandemic hit, or when like the notions of lockdown started coming, I was not in the UK.
Oh, yeah!
I was abroad in Sri Lanka because I went to see my grandmother with my family at the beginning of March. And as the holiday progressed and we were getting updates about how the world situation was going, it's like, am I going to be able to get back? I was having chats like 5.5 hours delayed between like Alex and Hannah and Johnny about like what we are going to do and how we can communicate things, because at this point I didn't have any assistance, so all comms was running through me, and how we were going to work this if I was stuck abroad for 2 weeks, an extra month or so. So it's like learning how to communicate in a crisis is very much something I have learned through all of this, and it's been weirdly fun in places with Magnus.
Wrong. Always misery, never fun.
No. That chocolate tort is still going to be tasty because it's chocolate.
I don't know what any of you are talking about. I am a joy.
Indeed. I've got one last question before we finish all of this up. What would you say is your favourite episode or scene from season five?
It's a very, very recent one, and it's going to be praising Elizabeth again. It's 198. Precipice, where they push themselves off the cliff. I had genuinely like a shock, shiver, visceral reaction with everyone that pushed themselves off the cliff. Like, not just when Martin went, but like Basira and the archivist, each one, oh, I just felt it. I felt that. I was on that cliff and I didn't like it, but I loved it.
198 probably as well, specifically for the dialogue banter throughout that episode. It's one of the few episodes in the entire season that has like legit banter, where it is just like, we're on our journey, there might be stuff to discuss or whatever, but like once you get past that initial like couple of minutes, there's a lot of back and forth, and that's very rare in this season.
Because 197 is the one where, like, it drops the, like, these are the stakes. This is the final decision. This is what this ending is about. 198 is this, like, breather episode, taking a breath before diving into those last two. And so, yeah, I we did allow ourselves to be a lot, just to let the characters be funny in the way that they can be funny, you know?
I remember you chatting about that, and you were talking about how you were going to end it, or how you're going to script it with me and Lowry. And we were like, just ended up being like, ha ha ha, why don't they jump off the ladder? Ha ha ha. And you're like, ooh, I'll use that.
To be fair, I think I actually had the ladder episode in a completely different place, and I had, like, 198 was always going to be that slight breather episode. I think the ladder was from somewhere else, but I'd forgotten, and then I was like, 198, that was the ladder, I think? And you and Laurie were like, what ladder are you talking about, Johnny? And I was like, oh, I think, yeah, no, look, they were on a ladder, I'm pretty sure. And you were like, not according to the plan. And I was like, well, they're going to be on a ladder now, I think.
And that's what working with Johnny is like. Quote, now they're on a ladder.
God. This was like 8 or so weeks before, like...
That's not as big an excuse as you think it is.
There's plenty of lead time. Plenty of lead time.
God.
Yeah.
I guess for me, 170 or 171. One where Martin is basically got like a symptoms of dementia. And that's just because I think it's just so well acted, which means that it's also got great writing, Johnny, because, like, you know, good acting has to go with great writing. Oh.
It wasn't actually, like, dementia wasn't actually a deliberate touchstone on that. Actually, thinking about it, I would say that the Rain conversation with himself is maybe one of my favourite episodes to have written, just because it's the sort of conversation that, like, it's just the whole situation and, like, having the weight of, like, 180 episodes of character development behind it. Nice kind of dialogue and, like, a lot of different ideas, and, like, you don't need to worry about setting stuff up. It can all just be this slow, thoughtful discussion. Like, it felt like a real payoff to me, writing it, at least.
I'm going to be horrendously biased here with my favourite scene, and it comes from 191, where, thank you, I got to have a cameo, and the scene where Aaron is snarking at Martin, where we just got to be really, like, fractious. People think, oh, well, what will happen when two poets meet? And it's like, I wonder.
The problem is that Martin's really, really good at poetry, and he doesn't suffer fools. That's the problem.
Yes, that's exactly how I'm describing it when I'm talking about his...
I also like that actually, from the poetry side, you are both of them.
Yes, exactly. It's weird because I have actually written the poetry profiles for both of them, and we have discussed this. So yes, there is Aaron poetry coming as well.
So what I'm hearing, Annal, is that your favourite scene really is the scene where you played against yourself. Which I can sympathise with, don't get me wrong. But
yeah, from
I mean, and the editors love it when there's a scene where the same person plays two roles.
Oh, I feel so bad. I think it was Nico that did the vocal cut for that one. Yeah. Oh, I feel so bad for them. So bad having to work from that. I've done that before. I've edited other people doing that as well and things like that. So the only solution you can do is over-record. But that does mean that you go to someone like, cool, here's a 15-minute segment. Here is 6 hours of audio.
I kept getting messages from him when he was working on it. Like, can I, like, there's quite a lot. Can I get a few more hours? And I was like, yeah, Nico, yeah, that's fine. And then another message being like, yeah, no, there's a lot. I'm going to need more time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. That has been most enlightening. I hope you listening at home have also found that very interesting. Thank you very much to everyone. Stay tuned for more from the wrap-up of Season 5. So, bye!
Bye, thank you, Anna! Bye!
This episode is distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 international license. For more information, visit rustyquill.com, tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook, or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.
Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice in the Magnus Protocol, and I'm here to tell you about From the Library of Jürgen Leitner, an upcoming novel available for pre-order right now at rustyquill.com/novel. Return to the world of the Magnus Archives in From the Library of Jürgen Leitner, an official prequel novel written by Nebula, World Fantasy and Aurora award-winning author Premi Mohammed, with the help of the Magnus Archives' own writer and lead voice, Jonathan Sims. From the Library library of Jürgen Leitner explores an infamous organization from the Magnusverse for the first time, the perilous private library of the enigmatic collector Jürgen Leitner, where occult books are guarded and researched at a fatal cost. Leitner's library keeps the dangers of these books in check and the would-be readers safe, or so Leitner claims. For two of Leitner's employees, the risks are worth it. For Hugh Franklin, the library is a place to belong. For Sebastian Everett, the library is an opportunity to indulge arcane ambitions. Though their 10 years at the library were years apart, Hugh and Sebastian's stories unfold in parallel, and their footsteps echo down the same eerie aisles, caught in a web spun long before either ever heard the name Jürgen Leitner. Will they find a way out, or will the library consume them before it's too late? From the Library of Jürgen Leitner will be published on October 27th, 2026, and is available for pre-order now. Visit rustyquill.com/novel for more information. That's rustyquill.com/novel.